It took a lot of just grinding and work every day, getting up and just picking up the phone, even if you get rejected 100 times, just picking it up again and calling. And just through exactly that, through hard work, we eventually found another big client and then another client. And so we've slowly been building ourselves up one client at a time, so to speak.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Eric Reinacker from Sentinel Finance Group. Eric has a very interesting story, a story that a lot of people have taken a step with in the last few years, which is to step out into the world of being a fractional CFO, having a storied existence working on the West Coast with some very high profile clients. He's finally decided, for reasons we're going to get into, to launch his own business. And we're going to kind of get a check in on Eric's first year in business and find out how it's been. And he has an interesting story about his experiences so far, particularly with one particular client. We're going to see what we can learn about that. So, Eric, thank you very much for coming on the show. And maybe you should just start off by telling us a bit about yourself and where you are in the world.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having me on, James. I really appreciate it. It's a big honor for me. So we are located in Lawrence, Kansas, which is just north of Kansas City. So a pretty big hub in the center of the United States. And just a little bit about myself. I'm originally from Germany. I've spent most of my time, though, in California. Was a fractional CFO consultant over there for a consulting firm in San Francisco for just under 15 years. Was a partner at the company. Then ended up selling my partnership and moved to Kansas City for family reasons. And I just started my own business about a year ago.
Very good. And how did you step into being a fractional CFO on the West Coast? What did you transition from? Or was this, how did you get into this in the first place?
Yeah, so I come from an accounting background, basically. I have a degree in economics, but then I went through accounting route. And I really started at the very bottom. I started as like a staff accountant, bookkeeper, and worked my way through the ranks, like learned how to book all the different journal entries and close all the books. And then eventually was a controller at a company for a number of years. And then through gaining experience, I had a really great mentor over there. He taught me a lot of the ropes. I broke into kind of the CFO consulting role and did that as a number of years. And then eventually as a partner of that company. So I gathered my experience really just working with a huge number of different companies in the Bay Area, just met different people, shook hands, learned their problems, learned how their businesses worked, basically.
And it's sort of a storied existence working in the Bay Area. When you say the Bay Area, in my world as a tech guy, how do you know someone in tech has been to the Bay Area? Because they tell you. They love to say, it feels like if you're there, you're in the middle of the universe. What was your experience of it? It seems like this mystical unicorn-bound place with, what was your takeaway from 15 years working over there?
Yeah, it's very dynamic and competitive for sure. San Francisco area specifically, and Oakland as well. There's a lot of great companies, and it's always, big companies with big reach. Like they're oftentimes are trendsetters in their local markets. But also it's a good market for small businesses. So I think it's a great place to start. You meet a lot of really bright minds over there and unique individuals. So from that perspective, as a career, I think there probably was not a lot of better places to start, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's probably the best place in the world. It's got that reputation. So if it's so good, why are you in Kansas? What happened?
Well, there's a number of reasons, but I would say the biggest one was family. We kind of did a little bit of a migration over time to Kansas City due to grandkids and marriages and things so forth. So what ultimately drew me to Kansas City was just being close to family. It's very important to me. But then also California, obviously with all the upsides, is very expensive. The area where I lived in, we had those huge fires multiple times. I was evacuated 3 years in a row, basically. And so it was just, everything kind of came together. And I was like, it's time to move.
Yeah. And we can't leave out that if it's okay to mention, you're a new father as well. That's also a big change in your life.
Well, coming up, due date's October So we're getting there. Yeah, very excited.
Yeah, very good. Okay, so this is, I mean, I've done it myself. Loads of people do this. You get into your career, you get some young girl pregnant, you know, and then suddenly the world changes. Suddenly you're not measuring life in months anymore. Now it's quarters and years and decades, and priorities change. When we got pregnant, we bolted straight back to South Africa for the in-laws' help where they were. And, you know, primarily we were worried about babysitting becomes a lot more important compared to anything else. And it's also how, well, that's where we started Procurement Express. Like, I started Procurement Express because I hadn't got a real job and I had an extra mouth on the way, and suddenly things got real, real quick. So I can empathize with that. You're in a lucky situation in that you have got the experience. So you got the product, if you like, but you are in Kansas, and you're not, it's not that you're not in Kansas anymore. Here you are. And suddenly, I guess you got to build it all up again. Right. So let's start off maybe with this story of, you know, your first year. How's it been going so far? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about your experience with your early clients. What have you learned so far?
We got a really good start. We got a client right away, which gave us a lot of confidence. And, you know, we really started with just picking up the phone and cold calling and just reaching out to people. And so we started off pretty strong. And then I would say things kind of just became a little bit slowed down a lot at the beginning of the year. We're struggling finding a few clients. Took us a couple of months. And I would say that was kind of probably the hardest time, is staying, you know, true to your vision, believing in yourself and thinking like, okay, everyone goes through this that builds a business. It's not going to build itself overnight. Just because you got one big client in the beginning doesn't mean, you know, it's just going to fall in your lap. So it took a lot of just grinding and work every day, getting up and just picking up the phone, even if you get rejected 100 times, just picking it up again and calling. And just through exactly that, through hard work, we eventually found another big client and then another client. And so we've slowly been building ourselves up, you know, one client at a time, so to speak.
I know you may not feel like it right now, but these early days are always the bits that put goosebumps up my neck. And it also, the early clients, like the first clients, are just so exciting. It's like, because it's so important. And you have to, I don't know if you listen to the Prof G Markets show, but that guy, I forgot his name now, he always explains like the people who have the grit to be able to shovel down spoonfuls of, I won't say what, and keep going are the ones who succeed. And that grit is really needed. So when you say you just call people, were these friends or referrals? Did you open the phone book?
I would say all of the above. It was where we found the most success is really, you know, finding local directories like a chamber of commerce, or, you know, we looked online for articles where it's like fastest growing companies in Kansas City. And I would just go through the list. There might be like 500 businesses and call every single one of them. My wife was emailing all of them. And then any opportunity we got, if there was a small business meetup or a, you know, whatever finance meetup in Kansas City, we would drive down there and we just shake hands. And even though I was very nervous, I would just go up to people and say like, hey, my name's Eric. I've got a CFO consulting business. I'm just trying to get to know them.
I love it. I mean, so when you say you cold call, literally get through to the receptionist. You know, do you have a finance guy? Do you have a CFO? They say no. You say, oh, great. Can I talk to the CEO? How did you get over that? Because there's a lot, it's hard. It's very different, you know, in the, let's call it the ivory tower of the finance team sometimes, you know, where it's all very theoretical and, you know, it all makes sense. But suddenly you're faced with rejection, making those calls. How did you set yourself a target every day? Or did you just say, no, I'm going to do 10 a week? Or how did you push through that barrier?
Yeah, I mean, it is about being disciplined. And the target was usually about 20 to 25 a day. So we just get up and just call them up. And I mean, there's no magic, you know, no magic wand you can wave. I got to learn a little bit how to speak with people. And I just learned that being on script is not a great way to do it. For me, what worked is to just be natural and just say like, hey, how are you doing? You know, I'm a CFO, just keep it very basic. Like, this is what I do. I've been doing it for years. Do you guys have any needs? And if someone says, nope, I have no needs, then sounds good. All right, have a great day. You know, next person, just keep that going until you find someone that says, oh, hey, perfect timing. Our controller just left. We need someone or whatever. You know, like that's the end, basically.
Yeah, that's another thing you just hit on there, which I love. I'm sorry to be so excited about this, but the difference between success and failure is paper thin sometimes. Like not making those calls, I'm making those calls. Even if you not get any business through it, it makes you hone your message, and your message gets better and better and better when putting the reps in. And I love it because, you know, I had to do the same thing at one stage, and I know how hard it is, and it's really cool. I love it. You know, some people have an uncle and they get them started or whatever. It's like, yeah, you know, good for you. But a lot of us don't have that. So what are you going to do? Okay. So you got going with your first, you know, significant client. I don't know if you want to talk about that a bit, because I feel like you had some good learnings from that experience. Sounds like it was a lot of work. Maybe you could just dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the first client we had was a very kind of standard, you know, meat and potato client for me. You know, it was basically a person that had a smallish business that was growing as a talent agency in Kansas City. And I just brought in systems. You know, I helped her basically build up her finance systems, meaning like cash flow reporting and financial reporting, and just advice on how to get funding for her business and so forth. And yeah, that was a good experience because it gave me a lot of confidence that, you know, it can happen. You can have that client on your own. And I started realizing it's like, oh, wait a second, I've done this for almost 15 years. This is the same as before. Like, I already have a skill set. It's no different. So in that sense, it was very good for us, I'd say.
Yeah. Okay. And then, I mean, it's very different as well, getting a client that you have found yourself. Like, did it feel different compared to, you know, having someone else you hand a lead and whatever? It felt different having...
Oh, yeah. I mean, 100%. I feel like that's another thing I had to learn in the beginning is it's probably very natural when it's your own client to just feel this urge to just knock it out of the park, you know, get an A+, just be perfect. And that's, you need to be as a, when you're starting your business, because obviously you need to be like very competitive. But the downside of that is you also get very kind of emotionally invested, which... we'll probably talk about that later with the construction client, but it is just truly like you have to kind of learn basically that a job's a job, and you know, you do the best you can for your company and balance that with you know, keep the big picture in mind, understand like what your business goals are. It's not all about just that one success or failure, basically.
Yeah, and this is a struggle we still have, which is that, you know, there's the sort of sales motion, there's the marketing, and then there's the implementation. And there are two different languages. It's not that it's different. It's not that you're trying to, you know, do anything, but it's just a different mode. Like it's like that very hard to be the guy who sits down and does the work, and then the guy who's talking to people about services. It's like a different part of your brain or something. I can't explain it. I mean, that's why we have, I guess, operations and sales teams separate them out, because it's a different thing. But at that early stage, you got to do both, right? You've no choice. So it's early on, you know, you got introduced to this, you know, builder that had an innovative construction sort of idea, I guess. He had an idea to go big or go home. He didn't have the capital for it. You can tell us a little bit about what happened there.
Yeah. So this is a gentleman I met again, cold calling, just called him up on his website. And he's like, yeah, I have a great idea. I want to meet with you. So I met with him downtown Kansas City, spoke with him, and just gave him my spiel of, you know, I help companies grow. I put the right systems in place. I help them find funding with a network and so forth. And then he explained to me kind of like, that's perfect. I've been a builder for 15 years. We did traditional home construction, and I'm switching gears. I want to do what's called 3D concrete printing, which is kind of a new thing in the construction business. It's basically, rather than doing, you know, the drywall construction, they basically print the walls. There's some big companies out there, like in Texas, I think one of them is called Icon. You know, they were talking about building bases like on Mars with this stuff. And so it's just really, really like this buzzword, right? Like everyone's excited about it. It has, you know, it's 50% less environmental imprint. It cuts costs and all this stuff. So it sounds really exciting. And there's just a lot of like appetite to anyone we spoke to about it. So he kind of got me hooked too. I was like, oh, that sounds great. You know, this sounds like a huge like vision and dream, and this is great. Like, let's go for it. Let's do it. You know?
Yeah. I think I've seen, if you haven't seen these houses, it's like a giant sort of egg pipe that's piping out concrete, and the houses, you can recognize these houses because they don't have right angles, right? Like,
right.
They're sort of round, so they have their own thing. And yeah, I mean, it sounds great. You spend less time on site, you set up your rig, and you print your house in what, a couple of weeks or a week or something instead of months? Is that the
benefit?
Yeah,
exactly. I think it's a couple of weeks. Yeah.
And let's just think about the business model there for a second. So obviously less time on site. That's the benefit, right? Mm-hmm. I guess the machinery is expensive. So how do you think about a business model for, is it just to make houses cheaper, or was there some other angle, you know, in terms of making this thing a success? What was the vision there?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a perfect question because, you know, that's what I went into this thinking. How do we make this work financially for your business? How do you scale this to a large enough place where you get a return on your investment? Because the machines are expensive. They're about $1 million a machine. And for, you know, if you're doing a big development of, he was targeting 200 houses, they were targeting 5 machines. And so if you're upfront, you're putting $5 million down, it takes you about the full season. You know, it's not just the walls you have to build, but the full season of building is usually about a year. Mm. And then you have to also sell the house. Like, you're looking anywhere from a little over a year to 2 years to get any cash back into your business. Right. So it's a pretty difficult project to manage. So that was kind of what I went into with the mindset of like, this is the problem we have to figure out. How is this profitable? Will you get a return quickly enough to not run out of cash and so forth?
Okay. So I guess I'd expect most construction to be about 2 or 3 years anyway, right? So it didn't sound it was that much quicker in the end, or was that quicker than a typical build?
I'm not a construction expert. I mean, I would say that was kind of the thing that I walked away with. Like, I was not super impressed with kind of the benefits it brought. It sounded to me like if you go really large scale, you could start printing houses like quicker, but at a smaller level, it just didn't really seem worth it.
Okay, so maybe we're hinting at what's going to come later on. But so this guy's like, okay, I need 5 million. So I guess funding was the first problem you had to solve for him, or did he bring the funding with him?
So the first problem was he ran his business basically in his head, right? Like, he's like one of those guys, like typical construction guys who had everything on a block of paper. He knew how much money in the bank. And then like his last project was funding his next project. It's very typical in that industry. I see it all the time.
Yeah.
And so the first thing I had to do is really get him some solid financials, right? Like, I built him from scratch, like a P&L and a balance sheet. I looked at his tax returns, some good old fashioned accounting work from him. And then, yeah, the next thing really to start the project was like, how do we get the funding in place? And then how do we plan out to make that funding last? And we discussed, you know, the options available, which are just the typical options for everyone. It's like, you can go to a bank and get a loan. You can have a wealthy relative that you know that can fund something, or you can go more of like a specialist. Like, if there's a VC firm in Kansas City that likes construction. And so we played with all three ideas, and we reached out first to, I have a network of venture capitalists in this area that I've been kind of building just through these meetings. I met a lady in downtown Kansas City who's fantastic and plugged me in, but reached out to them, see if there's any appetite. They kind of let me down a rabbit hole for a while. We reached out to his bank that he's worked with previously and were in advanced conversations with them at one point. And then we also had like an investor, like a package of forecasts and projections and all that kind of stuff that we reported to some of his investors and not investors, sorry, his private people that he knew. Like, he had a connection to the Walmart family called over there, someone over there. So anyways, it was kind of an approach of all three angles trying to find funding to him to get this thing moving. But we ran into obstacles pretty quickly, basically.
Okay. And what were those obstacles?
The obstacles were that the biggest one was basically that it didn't have enough cash up front to start it. You know,
right.
He was thinking that this idea was big enough, naively, I would say, that people would just give him money and would start it. And I would say to some degree that worked a little bit, that everyone was interested and wanted to give him, you know, their ear and have a conversation with them. But at the end of the day, that's always where it fell short, right? The bank wanted 25% of the 5 million down, and he just couldn't make that work. Same thing with investors. They're like, sounds great, I'll give you $1 million. Are you putting in $1 million? He's like, no, I'm not. And that's people lose belief in your company, kind of.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So not enough skin in the game. He thinks it's a great idea, but, you know, wasn't able to commit to that on your side. So,
yeah.
I mean, this gets quite stressful, I guess. Is the business still running at this stage and you're trying to make this happen? Had he made commitments ahead of getting the funding? I guess even in terms of he had not really seen what his business really was like financially until the EU came along. He had no clue, right? So it became a little bit stressful after a while. So what was the source of that stress?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm like literally as we're having this conversation, like the stress is coming back on me a little bit. But because it was exactly what we spoke about earlier. It's that balance of not letting yourself get so involved because this is one of your like big opportunities, your clients for your business, right?
Right.
So the mistake I think I made and is just really going all in with my heart and wanting to do the best possible job here to help this guy out. And then in the end, I kind of realized, well, that's it doesn't matter what I do here. It's not going to solve the problem. The problem is that there's not enough funding, you know? And so it caused a lot of stressful nights because I put a lot of, expectations on myself. He was running low on funds, so there's times when he wasn't paying me, which was very stressful. And so just the combination of that, yeah, it caused some stressful days and nights.
Yeah, okay. So in those days when you have a handful of clients, it's almost like being worse than an employee because it's important, it's a large part of your income, and yet there's no continuity there, right? Like you could be gone in the morning, et cetera. And then of course just you start to get caught up in the thing, right? So you're no longer just dealing with some abstract business, you're right in the guts of it, dealing with the entrepreneur, I guess having fights every now and again. And I feel like this actually, you're explaining to me before the call, your wife and you were worrying about this. Like, what was your wife worrying about it for? Like, that would not happen in a normal job. Why isn't it happening this? So,
Exactly.
what was the takeaway from that whole experience? When you think about your ideal client, would you do anything different the next time, or what have you learned from it?
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of big takeaways from this. I think ideal client's a good word there. I think the biggest challenge I had to overcome is that belief of that just because this isn't working doesn't mean that I, as a CFO, that I'm a failure or that I no longer know what I'm doing. It's kind of that self-belief of like, no, this, you still know what you're doing. Like you've been doing this for 15 years. You've been doing this for other companies. It's fine. And so eventually what it came out to be is like really defining your product, what you're selling. Like I'm not selling everything from top to bottom. I'm not your life coach because I almost turned into this guy's psychologist at points, you know? Like what I'm selling is, forecasting. I'm giving you feedback on your financials. I'm helping you find funding. It's not that I have to, hold your hand and walk you through the whole thing. And so I think the biggest lesson for me was just being clear up front about what services I provide, standing by those, like really performing those, but just having clear professional barriers and saying, this is my company, this is what we do. If that works for you, fantastic. If not, all good. I'll go to the next person. So
Yeah.
I think that was probably the biggest lesson there.
It's not infrequently that I meet fractional CFOs who do actually just become a coach or some sort of therapist or whatever, and that's what they're into. Like they love that stuff. Me, that would put shivers down my spine. Sounds like it might not be your cup of tea either. But you got to define what you are and what you're not. Some people are going to be like that. Some fractional CFOs are going to be a shoulder to cry on and a vision setter and a whatever shaman or whatever. There's everything out there. Some people are going to be real, give you the numbers, keep you the setting out. So that's very cool. I really appreciate you sharing that story because I know it's really interesting. I was very fascinated when people getting started, and I love, it's weird. You walked away probably from the corner office where you were, and now you're back to the start. I often wonder what would happen to me if I had to do that again, but I really, really admire what you're doing. So, okay, cool. Now, you have a particularly good website. You've
Thank
been
you.
putting effort into your blog here. So I'm going to ask you there's a couple of things, quick fire section. We don't normally do this, but I don't normally have such a good website to research on. So there's three blogs that I recommend people go and have a look at. I'm just going to ask you briefly about them here, and let's have a quick chat. The first one is why a CFO should have a economics background, which is a particularly self-serving title, if you ask me, because you have an economics background, but that's fine by me.
That was the
So,
idea.
what did your economics background give you that a regular CFO, what's your take on why that's important?
Yeah, just before I answer that, just real quick, I just want to give credit to my wife because the website is good and the blog is good because of all the work she does there. So Love Thank
that.
you. Thank you for that fantastic work. But I would say econ degree has served me well because, it gives you that like big picture of how the market works, how companies interact with each other, how the different sectors of a company interact with each other, really how companies act differently when they're small compared to when they scale. It gives you a unique perspective. I've worked with lots of different professionals and I've worked through accounting and finance, and I feel like in the accounting role, you often like get drawn into, get that balance sheet strong, your P&L has to show 10% profit, whatever it is. It's a very focus on like numbers and data. A lot of finance people, they're very focused on like ROI and ratios and forecasting and things like that. And I think the economics background is unique in that it gives you more of like a perspective of what is happening in the market as a whole. Let's look forward. Like, what does this mean truly? And so I always just think that like having that balance of understanding accounting and econ gives you a unique perspective because it lets you kind of live in the short term and the long term at the same time.
It's fascinating. I have no economics background, the government has just changed in the UK recently, gone to a Labour, or you would call a socialist. You probably Americans would probably say everyone over here is socialist, but the more socialist back government, and they've straight away started talking about, private sector price gouging, that sort of stuff. I believe that's also been talked about over in the US, and it started me wondering, well, why is a 10% profit reasonable? Like, what is that too much? Is that gouging? Is a 20% too much on gouging or whatever? And I was it only really occurred to me recently, well, if I put the money in a bank these days, I'll get 3%. So it has to be, and if you want to get capital into a project, so if you have capital, you want to fund something, you got to get them better than 3% because you could just do that in the market or even the bank. 7%, let's say, in the stock market. So 10% for a private business, extra bit of risk, obviously. That sounds reasonable, and then you go into a startup or whatever, and you're like, well, maybe you probably need more return on that. So that broader, it's not for nothing that we, do have these metrics. And it's always fascinating to me how these metrics pop up again, like Rule of 40, like these sort of rules of thumb are there for a reason. They make sense. They fit into a wider picture. Yeah. And it's good. And it's good you have that, you bring that up because then you see why, okay, cool. I can, we're doing all this stuff, but you know why, and it's just really important.
It just lets you make good strategic decisions. Like an example we bring up in that article is, the word recession has been looming around a little bit. People are worried. And I would say that as an economist, you don't look at it as this fearful term. You kind of realize, well, those are natural, those happen. And every recession is different. Just because one was one way in 2008 doesn't mean this one's going to be the same. And so you can also look at it like that's an opportunity. Like in the recession, your competitor might be doing worse, so you can acquire his company. So how about you shore up some cash right now, get your capital reserves high, set yourself up strategically that once that recession hit, that might be the best time for your business in the next 5 years. So it's like that mindset, I think, that sets it apart a little bit.
Next one I really liked was, protecting your equity while obtaining business funding. So you better explain that title to a civilian for a start. What does, because there's some jargon in there, equity, business funding.
Right.
Maybe you just think, yeah. What is it?
So,
And why is, how do you do it?
your equity is from an accounting perspective, it's basically if you sell everything you own in your company, and then you pay back all your loans, whatever is left in the bank, basically at the end of the day, that's truly like the most traditional explanation of equity. And the way it works is, like if you bring in a partner, for example, a venture capitalist firm, they're going to say, we'll give you $1 million, but we want 25% of your equity. So that means future in the future period, so in the next year, any profit bottom line that your company produces, in the simplest term, they get ownership of a fraction of that. So let's say it's $1 million, they get 25% equity, they get $250,000. You might say
Right.
that sounds like a great deal, but if you think about it in the long term, they're not going to go away after a year or 2 years. And so if your business is growing drastically, and they might give you $1 million and you end up giving them $50 million in the short run because your business has grown so quickly, that's a great deal for them. Now, I'm not saying that's good or bad morally or anything like that. That's fine. It's the business deal. But the calculation you have to make basically is what are you using those funds for that you're getting from this investor? And what you have to do, the calculation is basically, does the money you're getting, is it benefiting you overall more in the long term than what you're paying out to them in the long term? What you could say is like an easy example, like a hyperbole would be if Sam Walton from the Walmarts, well, I think he's probably dead by now, but say a Walton member comes in and gives you $50 million and they say, we want 10% equity. There's no way, if you're anything like me, or just a regular business owner, that you could make that kind of money in a quick term. So that gives you a massive opportunity for growth. So in that, it's a no-brainer, right? You're like, I'll take that equity partner that'll catapult my business into the next level. Compared to if you go the complete other side, you have your uncle gives you $50,000 and wants 25% equity. Like, great, I can pay my business debt down. I'm a little leaner. But then you, through your own hard work, you make it big. Now your uncle's getting 25% of your profits. It's like, why am I paying him? He didn't help me that much. So just somewhere in between there, you have to make a good decision as a business owner.
Okay, so just one last one from your blog is how to measure business value. It's not just about revenue. That confused me because I thought it was about making money. What does that mean?
Yeah, and I think this is kind of the message I try to drive home to all my clients. I think it's a real easy trap to think it's all about revenue growth. So many companies, they like, especially the smaller businesses trying to grow, they're like, it's all about just make as much money as possible. And I would disagree with that. And I think most CFOs would, if I can be so bold. I think what's more important is your profitability.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, let's say, okay, make $50,000 this year, and you're making 50% profit, you're taking that home. If you just take on as many jobs as you can, and you become very bloated in terms of like extra labor you have to take on that's now running inefficiently, extra expenses and so forth. And your gross profit is shooting down, right? As you're taking on more and more revenue, eventually you get to a point where a lot of companies are either too low in their gross profit, which means their operating margin might be too low, it's like they might be running a loss,
Yeah.
or things become disorganized. So basically, scaling your business for revenue doesn't always produce bottom line profit. So what I say is more important is focusing on organic growth versus just growing as fast as you can. Now, you have to take this with a big caveat with what I just said earlier, is that obviously there's opportunities that come along that you have to take, right? That's you can't just as a business owner say like, oh, I can double my business right here. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity. You have to take that for sure. It's a risk analysis. But in the bottom line, if you're just constantly focused on growth and not efficiency, you're setting yourself up over the long term for a world of hurt. And it's all about scaling. You cannot scale anymore if you're running at 5% gross profit versus 30%.
Okay. And you know, I mean, you may not even realize it, I guess. Your unit economics are out of whack. And, you know, at a certain stage, you're losing on every unit, but you're making it up in volume. That's the old joke, right?
I think it's a very good topic to talk about right now in this time period, because what I think I've seen now for quite a few clients I've taken in recently is exactly that scenario, is that we've been in a period of high inflation. And so overall expenses have gone up over the last 3 years. You can really see it when you look at companies' financials. And what I always run is, I look revenue versus expense percentages. And so across the board, they're going like this. And same thing with labor costs, those are going up. And so what's the business owner doing? His one play usually is like, let's get as much revenue as we can. And they oftentimes go for that like big hit, what I want to call like a Hail Mary. They're like, I got to start a whole new business line here or new product, something that's just cannot organically grow it in that time just to make up revenue. And that's, in my opinion, is not a good business decision because you're just like setting yourself up to run it inefficiently.
I'm smiling. I was talking with my wife last night, and when we were whippersnappers, like 20 years old or whatever, and we were talking about, you'd say, well, how much money is your number? What would be the number? And we say, oh, 2 million. 2 million would be, that'd be great. You could pay it off 80 grand a year. You'd live the big life or whatever. So I was talking with her recently, and I'm like, yeah, the number is probably like closer to 5 million. She said, wasn't it two? And I said, yeah, it was two 30 years ago. Now
Right.
it's changed. If you want to get that same lifestyle. And I was like, damn it, we're getting old. Yeah, that's true.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, that's basically in a in if you want to consider your own family, your own microeconomy or your business, That's exactly spot on, right? Like that's what business owners are facing. They're like, well, I used to make 10 million, now I'm gonna make 50 million, or now I'm gonna make 100 million. And like, that's fine, you can do that. But if that comes at the cost of increased business risk or just not making good decisions, you know, like hiring too many people, that's not a good long-term strategy for your company.
Okay, so you've been a brilliant guest. We're going to wrap up with my quirky little question I ask everyone, which is who's your business hero and why?
So my business hero would be my grandfather. His name was Willy Gress. He was a German entrepreneur, my grandpa. He started a power tool company called Gress Elektrowerkzeuge in southern Germany right after World War II. It's actually founded by my great grandfather, but my grandfather really ran it. And they were, you know, pretty successful there for a while. They competed up until the 80s with some of the biggest power tool companies in Germany and Europe, like Bosch. And then eventually, kind of the changing in the market with a lot of Chinese competitors that had just had like a different type of model, you know, like lower price point, became difficult for them to compete. But he truly, like, as a kid, you know, I ran around in that company. My dad was working there. My uncle was working there. And it just always gave me that vision of like, I can be a business owner one day. So it's a huge inspiration for me.
That's interesting because I have business success in my genes, let's say, and it always makes me, it gave me the confidence. Well, I have 99%. Well, no, actually, I guess I have 49% of the of the genes that those guys had. So has that given you that sort of belief in your su success self in yourself since a young age? Have you always thought now, okay, if they could do it, I could do it. Does it make a difference?
I think so. Yeah, I think somewhere deep down, I always kind of thought, you know, that's in my blood. I should do this. My grandpa did it. My great uncle had a business too. And so I just always kind of had that want somewhere to do it by myself.
Okay, thanks. And thank you. If you're still listening, congratulations. I have a special gift for you. And your gift is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. And what you'll find there is a webinar that I published recently. It does a couple of different things. So the main thing it does, it helped. I have learned speaking to dozens of fractional CFOs now at this stage, what the best fractional CFOs do in terms of explaining their value. And I've got a case study in there about how to explain your value in a way that really attracts the right type of prospects for what you want. And also, it's called Partners. So we've got a case study there of a guy called Ben de la Cretas. He works with TechCXO. He helps dozens of companies using Procurement Express. And he does it in a way that helps him make those companies really glad he hired them as their fractional CFO within the first 6 weeks. So it's kind of a hack that Ben discovered, and I'm retelling on him. You can also look Ben up on our podcast for a deeper role on that. So go to procurementexpress.com/partners, sign up, register for the webinar. I guarantee it's going to be worth your time. Thank you very much. And thank you, Eric. I've really enjoyed this. You've been a great guest. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you, James. I really appreciate it. It was, like I said, it really was an honor for me. I didn't expect it. So thank you for thinking of me. And just to everyone out there, listen to his podcast. I started just listening to him on my way to new clients to get myself in that mindset of listening to other CFOs. And I've been really enjoying it. So thanks a lot.